Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments. Today, Putnam manages money for more than 9 million individual and institutional investors worldwide. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I don't know where they've been the past couple of weeks. Seriously, I don't. But oil traders clearly started reading the newspapers again today. They discovered Russia invaded Georgia, that the Saudis might cut production, and crude jumped $5 just like that. That dragged other commodities higher, and it brought inflation right back to the front burner. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Gather.com, where friends keep up with the people, conversations, and moments that matter most. People are talking about the economy at Gather.com. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 21st of August. Glad to have you with us. For a change today, we start not with Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and the woes of the financial system, but with the vagaries of the international oil market. Crude stepped up today by the biggest percentage gain it's had in 2 months, 4.9%, $5.62 to close above $121 a barrel. The experts have been warning that the give back in prices this summer wasn't going to last. It hasn't for oil. It might not for gas. And that is going to spell still higher prices in lots of other areas. The Department of Agriculture came out today with its prediction for food prices next year, 4 to 5% increases on top of this year's already steep gains. Marketplace's John Dimsdale looked into why the highest food inflation in 20 years might be sticking around for a while.
Eggs, dairy products, and cereals are up 10% or more this year. But USDA says another big part of the American diet has seen only moderate price increases. Beef, poultry, and pork will be up only 3% this year. Ephraim Liebtag with the department's Economic Research Service says next year meat price increases will almost double.
In general, retail food prices take anywhere from 3 to 6 months to adjust to higher commodity costs, but the lag may be longer than that 6 months, could be over a year's time for the cattle cycle and for growing of products that end up being pork, poultry, and beef.
Even though energy costs are off their highs and corn and soybean harvests are projected to be near record levels, meat producers are facing feed shortages that will be felt at the grocery store next year. The American Meat Institute's Jesse Sefcik says livestock farmers are going out of business.
Right now, our cow herd hasn't been this small since the 1950s, USDA reported last week. Since the 1950s, we added about 130 million Americans, and so we're trying to get a feel on how much of a shock this might be, but we're definitely going to feel some pressure from this.
One way to escape some of the inflation at the grocery store is to head for a restaurant. Analysts say restaurants aren't passing on all their raw material costs to keep their customers coming. So if you don't feel like cooking tonight, by all means, go out. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
One reason the Federal Reserve pays so much attention to inflation is because it's insidious in a lot of ways. You don't necessarily notice it on a daily basis, but year after year, it can really take a chunk out of your paycheck. That's something the machinists union at Boeing will be thinking about as they begin their last round of contract negotiations this week. The country's biggest airplane maker is trying to draw a line in the sand on its pension and health care costs, but it's also desperate to get its new 787 Dreamliner out the door. Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Deliveries for Boeing's new plane, the 787 Dreamliner, are 18 months behind schedule. A strike now would be bad.
There's never a good time.
Tim Healy's Boeing spokesman.
You know, we have commitments, and not just the 787.
The company has a huge backlog of orders and has hired thousands of new workers. That puts Connie Kelleher at the union in the catbird seat.
It's definitely one of the best bargaining positions we've had in years.
Machinists want a raise, a cost of living increase, guaranteed pensions, and for Boeing to keep paying for most of their health coverage. Boeing's Healy says they'll win some concessions.
We've been successful. Employees deserve to share in that success. They've earned it, and we're going to do it.
U.S. steelworkers just inked a generous contract of their own, and these kinds of deals have caused at least one member of the Federal Reserve to warn that rising wages could spark an inflationary spiral. But machinists at Boeing have leverage other workers don't.
Machinists have skills that are in very short supply.
Ross Eisenbray at the Economic Policy Institute says almost everyone else is hurting.
It's a very bad time to be an hourly worker. Rising unemployment rate, payrolls are declining, and the underemployment rate is nearly 11%.
In fact, in the past year, real wages actually fell 2% when adjusted for inflation. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
There's word today Microsoft is going to start working on its image problem because it's not the hippest company around, you know.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC.
Oh, hey, iPod. Nice.
Yeah, it's just a little something to hold my slow jams.
Oh, yeah.
If the way to win over consumers is through comedy, the Wall Street Journal reported today that Microsoft's new strategy might just work. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson has the story.
Microsoft isn't commenting, but the figure being thrown around is $300 million for the whole rebranding campaign. $10 million of that is said to be on its way to this guy.
Hello!
Comedian and 1990s sitcom star Jerry Seinfeld. He's been a pitchman for American Express, and he had the lead in B-Movie. But some don't think he can make Microsoft cool again or counteract the negative image of its operating system, Windows Vista.
I just don't understand, you know, who are the ad wizards who thought this one up.
That's Aram Sinreich at Radar Research.
You couldn't really find a more expensive way to brand yourself as the premier company of the 1990s.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. But Sinreich says Microsoft should be targeting young computer geeks to build buzz. And branding expert Mark Gobe says old-fashioned fun is the wrong emotion for a technology product.
The expectation of the public, you know, for Microsoft is to be technology sexy brand, you know, the type of brand that can stimulate, you know, your thinking and can show you the future.
Of course, Microsoft would prefer if the future looks like the present. Windows is on 9 out of 10 computers, says Forrester research analyst J.P. Gounder.
Nevertheless, even though Microsoft is in this great position financially and in terms of market share, they've been suffering at the hands of, in particular, Apple.
And it should be noted that on the show, Jerry Seinfeld had a Mac. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Inflation, schminflation, it was an up day on Wall Street, gang. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Five years ago, the Federal Trade Commission set up the Do Not Call list. It stopped telemarketers from bugging us just as dinner was being served. It has also proved to be immensely popular. More than 150 million of us signed up. But somehow, the calls continued for a lot of us, thanks to a loophole in the rules. A loophole that let telemarketers use robocalls to make their sales pitch. This week, the commission heard our complaints and closed the hole, as Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
How many times has your dinner been interrupted by a call like this?
Hi, I'm calling from Advanced Informatics to let you know we provide online drafting services for only $8 an hour.
I don't care about your services. Leave me alone. That's my reaction, and I'm not alone.
Consumers are frustrated by pre-recorded telemarketing messages.
Lois Greisman of the FTC says the agency got about 13,000 complaints, so robocalls are banned unless requested. The new rules won't affect robocalls from charities or your doctor's office, and we're still able to get calls like this.
Hello, this is Hillary Clinton, the president calling. Barack Obama is not telling the truth about it.
But calls from consumers' cell phones aren't regulated. Susan Grant of the Consumer Federation of America says telemarketers are experimenting with interactive signs.
Where all you'd have to do would be to hold your mobile phone up to it, and a radio signal would trigger your phone calling a number.
Jerry Cirasale of the Direct Marketing Association points out that's perfectly legal.
As long as the consumer must take an action to make a phone call, I don't see any problem with any current regulation.
At least not yet. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The bump in oil today highlights an investment opportunity that's indirectly related to the price of crude. Even though the economy overall has been sluggish, investment in what are called clean tech companies grew 41% last quarter. Some say the red-hot clean energy sector is going to burn a lot of investors. But Kurt Nickisch reports from WBUR in Boston. There are plenty of others who are welcoming the green bubble with open arms.
Sahir Sirmeli is a corporate finance lawyer at a Boston firm involved in clean energy deals. He says the combination of high gas prices and calls for alternative energy are attracting investors like moths to a compact fluorescent light bulb.
You've got a lot of folks sitting there saying, wow, I see a lot of people are investing a lot of money in these emerging energy technologies. Where should I be looking?
He says money is increasingly flowing to emerging companies with as yet unproven business models. Some solar energy companies just years old now have market caps higher than GM.
In the same breath, I'd like to warn everyone there is a bubble, and it's great.
That's Bob Metcalf. He knows something about bubbles. The computer networking pioneer now helps run a Boston venture capital firm. It raises money to fund clean tech startups.
I will argue till the cows come home that the internet bubble was very much worth it and a great example of how a speculative fury can drive technological innovation. Now the trick is to repeat it for energy.
Metcalf's just one of a legion of former web entrepreneurs migrating to clean tech. Here in Boston, a nonprofit incubator program is even holding classes in energy policy for OneTime.comers.
Which dovetails a little bit with the exit strategy discussion we had earlier tonight.
At this session, in a corporate boardroom overlooking Boston, Chuck DeGatti is listening intently. Years back, he launched and sold software firms and had planned on starting another, but now he's hatched an idea for a clean tech business. He wouldn't tell me what it was, but says he's definitely got the bug for alternative energy.
It's just way too important and very interesting, potentially very lucrative outcomes as well, for you to think about going back to whatever you were doing. So I hope to do something ambitious in this space.
Ambition's great, but temper it with realism, says Bob Crowley. He runs Massachusetts' state-owned venture capital firm. Crowley says scores of investors caught up in all this clean energy bullishness stand to lose a lot of money.
If you throw enough spaghetti against the wall, it might stick. Well, there's a lot of spaghetti that ends up on the floor, and I think the same thing's going to happen here.
Still, advocates of the clean energy boom say the more spaghetti, the better. Russ Landon runs the Boston office of Canaccord Adams Investment Bank. He says for the technologies that do stick, the upside is enormous.
Call it a bubble if you want, but we are nowhere in terms of how big this industry, i.e. the clean tech industry, has to be.
Policymakers hope that a dozen years from now, renewable sources will provide 20% of the nation's energy. To get there, Landon says it will take tens of billions of dollars in private capital. So far this year, investors have raised $3 billion. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
So far, during the nearly 2 weeks of the Beijing Olympics, human rights groups say there have been 77 applications made for permits to hold protests. None of those protests have actually happened yet, and even applying can get you into trouble. A pair of Beijing women, 77 and 79 years old, have been sentenced to a year of re-education through labor just for putting through the paperwork protest. Commentator Jonathan Zittrain agrees that censorship is a problem in places like China, but there are things the censorees can do about it.
The 2008 Olympics has brought renewed attention to internet censorship in China. Websites concerning topics like Tibet, Taiwan, and Tiananmen are frequently blocked, and so too are more obscure religious and health sites and wildcards like MIT's homepage. As journalists found out upon arrival in Beijing, news sites are also common targets. Time magazine, the BBC, and the Voice of America have all been blocked in China. There are ways to circumvent this filtering for those willing to make the effort, but the overall system works well enough. Just think how quickly you'll give up on a website and try another if it merely takes a long time to load, much less if it never appears. It's possible that Western news organizations consider it a badge of honor to be filtered in China and elsewhere. Or they might want to shape the news they distribute to avoid censorship. but they should think it fundamental to their mission to ensure that their unadulterated work reaches all those who wish to see it, and they need to do a better job meeting their would-be audiences halfway. Accepting censorship might be necessary when delivery trucks, broadcast towers, and other in-country support mechanisms are needed to get newspapers or radio programs or television shows to willing consumers. For example, in 2002, The Economist magazine agreed to withhold its weekly edition from Thailand after the government objected to an article about the future of the country's monarchy. In 2000, Newsweek didn't even realize at first that Bangladesh had banned and confiscated its print run because of the magazine's article about women in Islam. But for overseas institutions that publish online, this doesn't have to be. News publishers could develop and use peer-to-peer networks and other digital means to get their word out around the firewalls. The same technologies that allow for the unauthorized sharing of Britney Spears' singles can also make news more available in places where it could compete with government propaganda. The wrath that news organizations might suffer from authoritarian regimes could be offset by loyalty from citizens who come to appreciate news from outside the bubble. And they'll remember, after liberalization makes technological workarounds unnecessary, who struggled to communicate with them and who did not.
Jonathan Zittrain is a professor of law at Harvard University. His latest book is called The Future of the Internet and How to Stop It. Before he does, though, let us hear from you. Do it online at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says Contact. Coming up, calling for quick answers to tough questions.
I need a quick money-making venture. Any ideas? Is today a good day to take off my shirt? When is the Lord coming back? This is a toughie.
But first, let's do the numbers. Kinda and today, really. The Dow Industrials added 12 points, a tenth of 1% to finish at 11,430. The NASDAQ unpacked 8 points, one-third of 1%, ended at 2380. The S&P 500 gained 3 points, a quarter percent, ended at 1277. The giant insurer American International Group lopped off 5%. Today, J.P. Morgan Chase chased away 2%. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs each lost around 1%. Analysts are predicting, yeah, you guessed it here, more write-downs on bad mortgage loans. Coca-Cola drained about 1.5%. Seems that jump in oil prices is taking away money from other things, like sodas. The 10-year T-note fell. The yield rose to 3.83%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by the Clinton Global Initiative, convening world leaders from government, industry, and NGOs to commit to action on global challenges. ClintonGlobalInitiative.org. Want more from Marketplace? It's all on our website. You can stream, download, or subscribe to podcasts of all our shows. And we have text of most stories, plus special reports and the Marketplace Toolbox. Check it out at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke talks about financial stability at an economic symposium in Jackson Hole, Wyoming. And on August 22, 1950, Althea Gibson became the first African-American to play in a U.S. national tennis competition. She competed in the United States Lawn Tennis Association's annual championship in Forest Hills, New York. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Who leads on the Olympic medal scoreboard kind of depends on your accounting standards. If we're counting by golds, then China's on top. If we're going by totals, then it's the U.S. But there are those who are using actual accounting to figure out who's ahead. That would be the companies that ponied up millions of dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars for some of them, to sponsor the games. Marketplace's Scott Tong is on the line from Beijing. Hey, Scott.
Hi, Kai.
So here we are. The games are almost over. We know who won most of the athletic contests. What about on the corporate sponsorship side? Who got the gold there?
Well, the marketing guys are still measuring the return on investments. But if you do kind of the instant exit polls and ask the experts, Coca-Cola comes up a lot as far as a company that has invested a lot of money in the games. Chinese people tend to know the brand, know that it's a sponsor of the Olympics, and therefore they're more likely to buy it. Now, this is how I got to experience Coca-Cola. When you walk into the Olympic grounds, there are no alternatives at the concessions. So you get Coca-Cola drinks and you get McDonald's food. It's kind of corporate sponsor prison. You get bread and water, you get Big Macs, and you get Coca-Cola drinks, and that's all you get. Obviously, that is good for the sponsors because they just suck the oxygen away from any other competitors at these Olympic facilities. And a company that's not even a sponsor of the Olympics is Li Ning, the Chinese sneaker company. You may remember the name. That's the name of the Chinese gymnast who won the gold medals in 1984, and he has funded a sneaker company, and they got this great marketing boost during the opening ceremonies when he lit the Olympic cauldron.
Step back for a minute, though, Scott, and let's talk beyond Beijing. Are there larger lessons that are coming out of these games about Olympic sponsorship?
There's a lot of skepticism about the future of Olympic sponsorship. If you set aside some of the companies that really know what they're doing, and this comes back to Coca-Cola, there is a lot of noise with Olympic sponsorship. There's more than a dozen international sponsors, and then there are domestic sponsors. And then there are all these other companies like Li Ning that ambush the official sponsors. They don't pay anything, and they get their names out there. And so you have a lot of confusion. A lot of people don't know, for instance, that Adidas is the official sponsor. And so arguably, that is money that has not been well spent. So the big question is what happens in London 2012? And four big multinational companies have already said, you know, we're going to take our $200 million and spend it on something else.
What about the investment that China made, not to host the games, but in the athletics? Did that pay off?
Mission accomplished. I read that one of the private goals before the Olympics was for China to win 40 gold medals, and it's already way beyond that. I mean, think about it, Kai. This is a country for whom the Olympics is about redemption. It's about status in the world. It's about coming out of the economic stone ages in one generation, and sports achievement has been a way for China to show it. Now, what did they put in? We're not exactly sure, but the ratio of what China spends on elite sports compared to the United States is something like 7-1. So they took those resources and they put them in this old kind of Soviet-style system of athlete factories. And then they chose sports that have a lot of medals. And then they trained. And in a way, it's paid off. And what folks at the U.S. Olympic Committee are worried about is this is a long-term investment. The China tally may get even bigger come London 2012 and beyond.
Scott Tong, our China correspondent. We reached him in Beijing. Thank you, Scott.
All right, Kai. Thanks.
The latest search engine rankings from Nielsen Online confirm what most of us already knew. Google leads the pack going away. It owns almost two-thirds of the 8 billion online queries that are made every day in this country. That's on the computer, though. What about searches on a different, but perhaps more common electronic device, one that most of us carry in our pockets? Search by cell phone is a different game. The screens are small, the keypads are cumbersome, and users are usually in a bit of a hurry. But there is still a business model for it, as Marketplace's Dan Gretsch reports.
Say you're at a dinner party, and the conversation turns to auction-rate securities. You could nod knowingly and keep your mouth shut. Or you could duck into the bathroom and call or text Cha-Cha. Within minutes, you'd be tossing around terms like nominal maturity and tax-exempt bonds. Brad Bostic is co-founder of Cha-Cha.
It's like having a smart friend available through your cell phone that can answer any question for you 24 hours a day on any topic.
Diana Braun is one of those smart friends or guides. Cha-Cha employs 20,000 Dianas around the country. They take questions and text back answers at no charge.
So here I got my first question. Cleveland or Pittsburgh, which is a better city?
She consults her favorite research tool. That would be Google. 52 seconds later, she's got an answer.
I think I'm going to have to go with Cleveland on this one. I'll give him a couple reasons why.
She texts back, visit the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and enjoy the lakeside views. Diana gets paid 20 cents for every question she answers. and they're not all that easy.
I need a quick money-making venture. Any ideas? Is today a good day to take off my shirt? When is the Lord coming back? This is a toughie.
Cha-Cha attracts its share of textaholics who bombard the service with goofball queries. But it's not all fun and games. Greg Sterling's an editor at SearchEngineLand.com. He says Cha-Cha provides a service of real value.
The human intelligence piece of this is like directory assistance on steroids.
He says people on their cell phone are on the go. They don't want to wade through search results. They want answers.
Let's take, for example, a plasma TV. You go into a particular store, they've sold out of it. Who else has it within a reasonable driving distance? Somebody who is ready to buy a product like that is really susceptible to sale information. That's the concept. Right time, right ad, right place.
Cha-Cha's Bostic says the plan is for guides to act as personal assistants, directing people to restaurants, movie theaters, stores.
That generates a revenue stream to our company. Instead of getting pennies like a search engine might, we get dollars because it's creating a very efficient exchange.
Cha-Cha is also looking at ways to target users with ads. The company hopes to turn a profit by the middle of next year. In the meantime, Cha-Cha is building an extensive database of questions and answers. 100,000 questions pour in each day. Mark Malseed is dean of Search University, Cha-Cha's training site for guides. He says eventually, guides won't have to rely on Google.
One of the things we are trying to do is collect these real gem answers, and when possible, we'll use them again, creating our own library of information snippets.
That database could provide insight into users' habits, something advertisers love. And it could make things easier for guides like Diana Braun when they have questions of their own.
All right, so the question I'm sending Cha-Cha is, I am a Cha-Cha guide. Why do I get so many Chuck Norris joke questions?
She says she gets 5 to 10 Chuck Norris queries every night.
So the answer is, it might be because he is always on late night TV and it's easy to make up corny jokes about him.
Another great mystery solved. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing nearly $9 billion in municipal bond assets. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, food is going to be more expensive, as John Dimsdale told us up at the top of the broadcast. But it might soon be safer, too. Starting tomorrow, the Food and Drug Administration is going to let growers zap their fresh spinach and iceberg lettuce with enough radiation to kill E. coli and some other germs that can do bad things to your innards. Meat has been irradiated for years now, of course. Some spices, too, interestingly enough. An FDA official did say today, though, that you still do need to wash all your produce, just to be sure. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow added 12 points, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ dropped 8 points. That is 0.3%. The S&P 500 bumped up 3 points. That's 0.25% there. Kevin Arnovitz, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor of the program is George Judson. Coming up next time, some Brits are questioning the Olympic dream.
My heart sank when we won the right to stage the Olympics. I thought that it was a disaster for Britain. It would be immensely disruptive, no fun at all, and we'd screw it up.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.